Risky Business. Risky Business. Risky Business.
Hello and welcome to Risky Business number 76 for Tuesday, September 2, 2008. I'm Patrick Gray. We've got a great show this week. There's been plenty happening in the InfoSec world of late. Our feature topic this week is BGP insecurity. There's been some renewed hysteria around BGP, and we'll be getting to the bottom of it with Danny McPherson, who is Arbor Network's chief smart guy. I think he's variably being called their chief security officer and chief research officer, depending on who you ask, but he's very on it, so he'll be along shortly. And there's been a lot of news lately about RFID and contactless RFID insecurity over the last few months. But some very interesting video footage from the HOPE conference, that's Hackers on Planet Earth conference in New York, has surfaced, and I'll explain that one soon. Before I forget, if you want to follow my Twitter updates, you can find me at twitter.com/riskybusiness, all one word. And if you're a first-time listener, you can subscribe to this podcast via the RSS or iTunes feed at itradio.com.au/security. Or alternatively, you can sign up for a weekly email alert when the new shows go up with a bit of a description of the show and a link in it. So head to itradio.com.au/security to sign up. This week's show is sponsored by RSA Security. They slice, they dice, and they know Alice and Bob's dirty little shared secret. RSA Security's Greg Singh will be along in this week's sponsor segment to have a chat about the MyFair disaster, key management, and other geeky crypto stuff. But first, as always, it's time for this week's news headlines with the greatest IT editor in the world, Munir Kataria. Now, Mun, this story I just love, which is inside, it's actually from ZDNet US, and it's a blog post by Danto Danchev, and it's inside India's capture-solving economy. It's a fascinating story.
This is brilliant. Okay, so listen, the basics are that for $2, you can have an actual Indian chap there solving 1,000 captures for you.
The subversion of capture has actually turned into a little bit of a cottage industry in India, where you can have, what was it, 1,000 broken for $2?
That's right, yeah, and then it gets further than that, because now they're using, you know, they're empowering their workers, it says in this story, that with web-based kits, APIs, and proxies to make their work easier, so they're more efficient, so they can solve more captures. And it's actually, yeah, like you say, turning into a proper industry here.
It just actually made me twig on something else that I saw recently. Yeah. If you actually go and Google worst captures of all time, and that's of course spelled CAPTCHAS, you'll find a dig link to the worst captures of all time. And it's just a funny little exercise.
Some of these, yeah, they're absolutely hysterical. They're things which even humans can't solve, right?
Yeah, and some of them that are just funny, like a Google capture that just says retard, you know? which is, you know, of course not very politically correct, but, you know, that's just what happens. But Google around, find it. It's definitely worth a chuckle.
What's really interesting about this, though, is that can you imagine the job satisfaction if you were actually one of these guys? I can't imagine how much you'd earn, but your whole time you just have to sit there and look at these and solve these puzzles for the whole day. It's an awful
thing. Oh, it'd be enough to make me want to put pencils through my eyeballs, you know. It's just not a very nice way to make a living. But
yeah, the story was actually on Slashdot as well, and one of the guys on Slashdot had the funniest comment. He goes, I know what to do, seeing as you can get these guys to solve the captures, why can't we have another industry coming up where you can get somebody to check your emails and be a human anti-spam machine? And you could pay them $2 to check 1,000 emails.
It's sort of like, that's outsourcing, isn't it?
Yeah, totally.
Outsourcing every single little menial friggin' thing, you know, to someone in India. Poor buggers. God, why do they have to do it?
Well, their economy's coming up, so give it a few years, and I'm sure they'll move it on and pass those jobs on to somewhere where they pay less.
Yeah, it'll be Africa next. I think they've been saying that for a while. All right. Now, in this next story, your underling, René LeMay, has quoted his former employer, the Australian Financial Review, as saying that Symantec paid a cool $300 million for PC tools.
$300 million, yeah, it's not confirmed, is it? It was a private company. So we actually spoke to a guy, Rowan Trollope, from Symantec last week and asked him about it, and yeah, he's keeping mum on it. Said he wouldn't say, but I mean, you know, the AFR are saying it. Oh.
Well, if the AFR is saying it, it means that, because it hints here, the newspaper said James Packer's family company, Consolidated Press Holdings, and a hedge fund associated with the media mogul had a stake in PC Tools. So it looks like it's leaked out of that end, not out of the actual PC Tools guys. But, $300 million, that's all right. That's better than a, kick in the balls.
Yeah, it's pretty good. I wouldn't mind an update on this. I mean, it's a decent amount of money. But have you heard anything about what they're going to be doing with PC Tools?
Oh, apparently it's going to be the poor man's Norton. That's what we're saying.
That was a headline. Liam came up with that one.
That's pretty good. Well done, Liam. Yeah. I always thought personally, Meneer, that Norton was a poor man's Norton, but there you go.
Well, we did grill semantic about this, but we couldn't get anything out of them. They say it's going to be a poor man's Norton, but I've got a feeling that at some point they could actually make it, a free version to actually compete on the same level as AVG and whatever, because they're not going to put it in with their own system. So they'll have a free version to compete with the other free tools and then their own paid-for version.
Yeah, I don't know how that's going to work, to be honest. But I don't know. PC Tools, some of the stuff was, moderately handy, depending on how it was deployed. So we'll just watch that space. It's just all endpoint security stuff that is designed to, stop stuff happening to your OS that your OS should actually be stopping. But anyway, great business. Good business to be in. Oh, here is a ridiculous old school security bug, which is the iPhone. You could press a few buttons and unlock it.
This is brilliant. So, yeah, you can put a password protection on your iPhone so that, when you pick it up and if you leave it on the table somewhere, someone else picks it up and they can't access your details. But it seems they can.
Yeah, they can. A mate of mine actually showed me at a restaurant, Adam Poynton, regular guest on the show. I'm down in Melbourne at the moment, and we were out at dinner, and he's like, oh, check this out. And of course, with that, his iPhone, he's like, and yeah, popped it open. But there's a very, oh no, he popped mine open, actually. There's a very easy mitigation. You can set the device so that double-clicking the home button will take the user directly to the home screen, which will be the unlock screen if password protection is turned on. So not the end of the world, but one of those stupid little security bugs that Microsoft used to get an absolute shellacking for doing stuff like that in their products, and it's nice to see a different vendor doing stupid things.
It is, but I think Apple can definitely learn from Microsoft here. I mean, you look at the Apple spokesperson quoted in this and they go, it's a minor iPhone security issue. If this was Microsoft, they would say password protection, it's not a security issue, it's not at all, it's actually a feature to help you spin it somehow and say, no, it's a feature to help improve flexibility or something.
Yeah, this is a usability issue.
Exactly. So, Apple, they need to get, in a bit of practice here, I think.
They need to work on their spin.
They need to look at Microsoft 5-6 years ago and see the kind of stuff they came out with and copy them.
Now, this next story, not very happy news for our favourite alien hunter, Gary McKinnon. He's the guy who's been charged with attacking NASA's computers in search of little green men, and he's lost his legal challenge against extradition to the US.
This is really, really sad. It looks like he's going to be sent there, and he's going to be done as well. I mean, he's not going to be treated well, is he?
He's going to be dropping the soap at Gitmo.
Yeah, it's true. Well, I mean, he's got one last ditch. What did they cut? He's been recently diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome.
Yeah.
So he's going, I don't know if...
The poor guy, I mean, he's just trying anything he can to keep out of the US court system, because the prosecutors said they wanted him to quote fry, unquote.
It's true.
So, I mean, they're not exactly saying we're going to give you a fair trial. They're saying, come over here, we're going to just pin you to the wall. We're going to nail you up.
Absolutely. I'm quite worried for the boy. He seems like a nice bloke, and he's just not going to get a fair trial. It just seems wrong.
Instead of spending millions of dollars on extraditing him and having him charged, do you reckon maybe instead they should actually just change the default passwords that allowed him to get into all of these sensitive NASA systems in the first place?
Do you reckon they have done that, or are they working on this fear thing so everyone's too scared to even look anymore?
I don't know. It's just, Jesus Christ. Talk about having your priorities wrong, guys. Yeah. I mean, find some asshole who's, hacking for profit to make an example out of, not some dude who was hacking NASA looking for aliens from his auntie's house, which is he was doing. But anyway,
totally with you there.
Yeah, Best Western has denied. There was a huge story that came out in the UK. I think it was before that. It was broken in Germany, saying that 8 million details had been exposed. But Best Western has come out and they haven't said, no, it was 5 million. They've said it was 10.
Yeah,
10 people have actually been affected by this. So there's been some overzealous reporting on this.
Yeah, because apparently it was just one hotel. They're saying, I'm not even going to try and pronounce the name of the hotel, but it's in Berlin. And they said that they found the Trojan horse and it was detected by the antivirus software in the hotel. And they say, yeah, 10 people have been affected. It didn't get to their main systems, and that was it. So,
well, they purged data after 7 days. I mean, from what, okay, the difference between what the UK and German press were saying and what Best Western was saying, I mean, you couldn't find more contrast.
Yeah.
The German and UK press are there saying, okay, look at this, you know, we've got 8 million customer records exposed. Anyone who's ever been to a Best Western in Europe has been pwned. Their credit card number's out there. Russian dudes are trading on it. And Best Western have said, well, actually, we got a virus, and Symantec popped up and said there's a virus on this computer, so we turned it off and we cleaned it, and we think 10 people have been affected. So,
yeah.
But I think what sparked the 8 million claims is there's some dude here, a guy who was actually quoted in the Sunday Herald in the UK, whose name is Jacques Erasmus. Erasmus? I don't know how you'd pronounce that. He's a security professional at Prevex, which is a malware behavioral monitoring company, and he reckons he's been monitoring online credit card detail trading forums, which he didn't name, and said that...
Said there was an Indian hacker.
Yeah, he says there was an Indian hacker selling a login to Best Western's systems with a screenshot saying the login can get access to credit card numbers and credit card verification codes. So, look, knowing really what's happened there is going to be a little bit difficult, but yeah.
Yeah,
I don't think it was either 8 million or 10. I think we'd probably have to pick a number somewhere in between.
It's a fair crack there, yeah.
Yeah. Tell us about this next story, Munir.
This I found really funny. Bank customers' details sold on eBay. So apparently a whole lot of people, which bank was it again?
Royal Bank of Scotland.
That's right, Royal Bank of Scotland, NatWest. Their details are sold on eBay. It was a server which somehow appeared on eBay without anybody claiming that they actually tried to sell it.
Yeah, well, what happened is someone didn't actually scrub the hard disk of some old equipment that RBOS had, and it wound up on eBay. Some dude bought it and found, yeah, heaps of details. I think it was name, date of birth, mother's maiden name, and signature. I mean, it doesn't get much better than that.
I think it's really funny because this company, Graphic Data, they say that one of their machines appears to have been inappropriately sold via a third party.
Yeah, it was just an oversight by the looks of things, but
yep.
I got a mate who works at RBOS in London, so hi, dude, you know who you are. And I just want to say, on behalf of Risky Business, good one.
Yeah, get him on the phone, Lou.
Yeah, I'll have to, just to tease him, send him a few texts anyway. But yeah, you know, we hear about this sort of thing all the time, about the old hard drives popping up on eBay with, you know, unscrubbed data on them, and it looks like that's all that's happened in this case. Now, here's one from securityfocus.com, not zdnet.com.au. I'm sorry, Munir.
Hey, that's all right.
Just didn't get to this one yet this week. I'm sure you will. But the United States government has issued a memo mandating that all major agencies adopt a proposed technology, and that's DNSSEC, to enable trusted lookups of domain name information by December 2009. Now, DNSSEC has been around for a bloody long time, but no one's really implemented it. And it looks like this latest round of DNS snafus is finally lighting a fire under everyone's ass so that they're going to go out and actually do it.
Yeah, I don't think this would have happened unless we'd had all the issues that we have over the past month or two.
Yeah, but we even had the same issues a year ago, you know, with Amit Klein's stuff in Bind, you know, same sort of disaster level. It just wasn't marketed as well. We just didn't have someone standing up there waving their arms around saying the world is ending. So even though Kaminsky's copped a lot of flack for being way too attention-seeking, maybe it's a good thing.
Yeah, I reckon probably is. So do you reckon this DNSSEC will actually happen this time?
Oh, the government sent out a memo. Problem solved. When does that happen, you know? You know what I mean? You hear what I'm saying, right? But, you know, with any luck, I mean, perhaps they can actually coordinate something. You know, we'll see. The US government seems to be slowly cottoning on to the idea that this, you know, internet security thing might actually be something they want to pay attention to. So.
Well, perfect timing, things are just about to change.
Yeah, we live in hope. We live in hope. Okay, Munir, well, thanks again for stopping by this week with the news headlines.
It's been a pleasure, mate. Chat to you next week.
ZDNet Australia's Munir Kathadia there with this week's news headlines. Before we get into this week's feature topic, we have a very revealing bit of audio here that I think deserves a little bit of time in the show. It's a video of Mythbusters presenter Adam Savage talking at the Hackers on Planet Earth conference. He was asked by an audience member why they don't do more on RFID security. The footage and audio of Savage's answer has popped up on Wired and Boing Boing via YouTube. Here it is, and this is what major credit card companies do when you threaten to expose their idiocy.
The one I wish you would revisit more is RFID. Now, I know that... Does Carrie still have the RFID tag in her arm?
Dude, the RFID thing.
Yeah, why did you not...
I'm sorry.
I'm not...
You, It's not going to happen. I discovered. Here's what happened. I'm not sure how much of the story I'm allowed to tell, but I'll tell you what I know. We were going to do RFID, and on several levels, you know, how hackable, how reliable, how trackable, et cetera, et cetera. And one of our researchers called up Texas Instruments, and they arranged a conference call between, I think, Tori and the head producer over there for the other team, Linda Wolkovich, and one of the technicians at Texas Instruments. We're supposed to have a conference call to talk about the technology on like Tuesday at 10 a.m. And Tuesday at 10 a.m., Linda and Tori get on the phone, and Texas Instruments comes on, along with Chief Legal Counsel for American Express, Visa, Discover, and everybody else. I mean, and I got chills just as I described it. They were way, way outgunned, and they absolutely made it really clear to Discovery that they were not going to air this episode talking about how hackable this stuff was, and Discovery backed way down, being a large corporation who depends upon the revenue of the advertisers. And now it's on Discovery's radar, they won't let us go near it. So I'm sorry.
No.
It's just one of those things, but man, that was a really... Your story still gets a little white when he describes that phone conversation.
And there you go. Those guys got heavied pretty hard by the lawyers there, so interesting to see their response. Nice one, credit card companies. It's time to move on now and have a chat about BGP insecurity with Danny McPherson from Arbor Networks. And unless you've been hanging out in the Tora Bora region lately, you would have heard this thing doing the rounds. Some guys did an unscheduled last-minute talk at DEF CON all about BGP insecurity, and it was apparently a pretty good talk. They actually man-in-the-middled a bunch of traffic destined for the DEF CON network and rerouted it through somewhere exotic. I don't even know where it was, but they pulled it off beautifully. Now, a journalist at a well-known online technology site got a bit excited and declared the internet under imminent threat of implosion again. I mean, that was very much the tone of the headline, was something like internet's biggest vulnerability revealed. But I guess they were just disappointed about Dan Kaminsky's DNS bug failing to unleash conquest, war, famine and death, as manifested by the four horsemen of the apocalypse. So anyway, this BGP story did the rounds and got a tad overhyped, sort of. I guess the thing is, while this might be old news, it's actually pretty important news that's just lain dormant for a long time. BGP is indeed a big pile of shit just waiting to cause us some pretty major grief. Now, our guest, Danny McPherson, knows his networking. In addition to his role at Arbor, Danny is currently a member of the Internet Architecture Board and co-chairs the IETF's PWE3 Working Group. Oh, how I wish I knew what that was. Danny also serves on the MPLSCon Advisory Board and the FCC's Network Reliability and Interoperability Council. You get the idea. He's also a keen bow hunter, so if you run into him at a conference, be nice. So, Danny, this whole thing, it's got people in a tiz.
Yeah, so I don't know that the DEF CON thing did so much as, you know, maybe the Wired article saying the internet's worst threat revealed or something to that effect.
And well, the worst threat to the internet ever is like the flavor of the month. That is the story du jour, exactly. Shall we say.
Ever this month. No, exactly. And, you know, I mean, like the DNS stuff, Kaminsky stuff was pretty ugly and it's something new. This, I think, the most interesting thing with this is that they really... you know, just showed a proof of concept of a couple of things that nobody had done. There was one unique thing in this that they used, you know, we can talk about in a moment. But, you know, all they did is basically tie a couple of things together that have been done. And you know, as far as the route hijacking piece, that's occurred many times. As a matter of fact, the sort of proxying or intercepting data and then forwarding on that path is how lots of folks actually mitigate DDoS attacks today. They divert traffic to those systems as sort of proxy or intercept the traffic and scrub the bad traffic and then forward the rest of the traffic onto the intended recipient.
Before we get into that, I mean, like, let's just talk from a very basic sense about what this attack is. I mean, what does the demonstrated attack allow an attacker to do?
So basically what the Tony and Alex demonstrated was the capability to, you know, more or less from an arbitrary endpoint on the internet. That's not exactly the case, and more or less with an arbitrary set of address space, which isn't exactly the case either. Basically advertise, you know, hijack a route on the internet, you know, do whatever you want with the data. In this case, you know, snoop the data, write it to disk or intercept it or manipulate it, whatever you want to do. In this case, presumably they wrote a lot of the DEF CON traffic, like 7 gig of DEF CON traffic to disk. and then forward it on to the original intended recipient.
So this is like a BGP man in the middle.
Yeah, no, that's exactly. It's employing BGP for a man-in-the-middle attack. And the unique thing is the inter-domain bit, or the unique thing to this demonstration is the is the inter-domain bit. So it's using multiple networks, not just a local network with ARP spoof or something like that, or route hijacking inside of a network. But it's basically, the thing I referred to in my blog actually was sort of poor man's traffic intercept or poor man's wiretaps.
From what I understand, you can't just like go after a single IP with this sort of attack. You have to grab like an entire block, an entire chunk of IPs, and really move a lot of traffic. And that tends to raise a bit of attention, doesn't it?
If you're paying attention, you should definitely see something like this. However, it's not easy to see if you're not paying attention, and that's why people need to understand, where traffic's coming from and going to, and people need to monitor their entries in, sort of in the global routing system. If, you ping some remote site, you don't necessarily know what any of the intermediate nodes did with the traffic, with your ping traffic, for example.
Mm.
But, all you know is that, it took this long for, for that packet to get there, for this packet to get back, or for this transaction to occur. And what this is doing is modifying, sort of the routing system to provide the traffic intercept capability and then forward the traffic on to the legitimate source. So we've seen lots of examples. Like I mentioned the DDoS example. Other places you've seen capabilities similar to this with the L root name server, for example, where one of the DNS root name servers was more or less hijacked for 6 months. They basically hijacked and served authoritative root name server responses to people that were querying that. The thing they didn't do was forward traffic onto another root. They acted as that root, and it's certainly something you could have done in this instance. But that's sort of one of the things that Anycast brings to the picture, is it makes it even more difficult to detect this kind of attack. But you did ask the question about a specific IP address versus a block of addresses. And generally speaking, on the Internet, you're not going to get something globally routed and reachable unless it's a /24 to a chunk of 255 IP addresses or larger. And the way we mentioned this on your show previously as well, is the way that the routing works is that if you have a more specific entry for something, in other words, if somebody is announcing 512 IP addresses in one chunk and you announce 255, they're going to prefer your 255 because it's referred to as more specific.
Yeah, it's more sort of granular, isn't it? And
yep.
Yeah, oh, you guys have got extra information for me, I'll take that.
Right, exactly. It's more specific. And so, by and large on the Internet, you can, if you want to game the system, you can announce pretty much anything you want today. And, some of the things we actually talked about last week at OSNOG was, some work going to this resource PKI. One of the fundamental problems here is that there's still no authoritative source for who owns what address space on the Internet and who's authorized to advertise what address space.
Well, I suppose this is what we've got to get to in this conversation, Danny, is what the hell do we do about this? Because, BGP,
exactly.
This isn't a security vulnerability. This is a feature.
Right. No, it is a feature of BGP, actually. And these guys, the unique thing, so to wrap up on the unique thing these guys did, because there's one unique thing there, was they basically, so BGP, when you advertise information between networks, it uses something called an AS path. And it's basically a list of the ASs or the autonomous systems or networks that route has traversed, right? And basically, the way that loop avoidance occurs in this, in other words, if I tell you something someone else and they try and tell me, I say, hey, I told him that, so discard that. Basically, there's a path vector in there, my AS number. And if I receive a route with my AS number in it, I don't accept it. And so basically what these guys did is they looked at the legitimate route, or their primary route back to the target, the recipient AS. And then they said, okay, I'm going to announce this prefix in the global routing system, and I'm going to prepend all these, all these ASs that are in the legitimate path back, and so that they don't use this routing information. So they're going to discard this update. And so everybody else on the Internet is going to use my update. But these three ASs or two ASs or however many are between them and the target are going to discard that. And that's what basically, that's what allows them to not only hijack the route with everyone else, but it allows them to get traffic back to the, to the target AS without a, without actually introducing any kind of forwarding loops or routing loops in the network.
But it sounds like all these guys have done is really flowchart out this attack, using documented functionality. I mean, it just seems that enough thought didn't go into the design of these routing systems to begin with. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think just like with IP spoofing or encryption or DNS, like last week, when all these protocols were initially designed, they were designed with the thought of open any-to-any connectivity with all non-malicious players on the internet, right? And basically what these guys did, and it makes sense, they basically coupled, four or five different things, like, for example, some TTL obfuscation stuff and some BGP route hijacking and then
the TTL interference stuff, that's kind of interesting because you cannot rely on your TTL under this attack. I mean, forget about it. It's going to lie to you.
They obscured that. Yeah, and it's kind of interesting because two guys actually that were involved in the initial work on TTL obfuscation or hiding those sort of paths. Tom Tosic with Modisano actually did the some original work on IDS evasion and he basically explored that. And then Doug Song, who was chief security architect at Arbor for quite a while, he actually wrote a tool, quite a while ago called FragRoute that provided this and lots of other capabilities. And, a lot of people had used it forever with things like ARPSpoof or EtherCAP, where on a LAN you hijack traffic and then you don't let anybody see that you actually did that. Mm. And this is just essentially applying the same technology to interdomain or to longer paths in the network. So Doug and Tom did some early work on the TTL stuff. And basically these guys tied a bunch of things together. There are lots of other ways without AS prepending that you can do interdomain stuff. Actually, one of the interesting places where I've seen just this kind of capability occur, but it wasn't highly broadcast, is a lot of folks, and I don't know if we talked about this in the past, but basically, there's this sort of conundrum about if you find a botnet command and control channel, should you, black hole it and drop all the traffic to it? Should you divert it to a researcher and so you can find out who's infected? Should you log on to it and monitor it? Or should you, infiltrate it and see what's going on? And I'm certainly aware of, 3 years ago, I think in 2005, of people that were diverting botnet command and control channels and proxying all the transactions and logging all the activity and all the hosts that were connecting to those, and then forwarding that information onto the legitimate botnet command and control channel interdomain on the internet using a technique very similar to what these guys outlined. Obviously, no one published a paper on that.
Because it was kind of illegal, maybe.
As a matter of fact, I suspect there's some law that was broken in the hijack they performed, and that's probably another reason why nobody does this. Because it's one thing if you're at a conference, or even at a conference for that matter, sniffing passwords is bad enough. But if you're doing some ARP spoof trick on a LAN or something to that effect, but if you're manipulating multiple people's routing systems on the internet for some amount of address space, I suspect that if somebody really wanted to push the issue, they could find a couple of laws that were broken with this.
Yeah.
And, most folks don't. I mean, and I don't want to point a finger at these guys because I actually, I'm happy that, sort of tying all this stuff together and finding a way to illustrate it for people that makes them a little more concerned shines more light on the insecurities in the global routing.
Yeah, I mean, and it's not like these guys were running around doing evil black hat shit, It's just...
Right, presumably, yeah. No, I don't believe they were. I don't believe they were either, actually. I think they wanted to demonstrate this, and I think that they did just that. And, tying a bunch of the technologies together and, publishing it is a fine way to illustrate the problem.
That said,
and to step into the solution space is it's something even at OSNOG last week, as a matter of fact, one of the things we talked about was routing security and this RPKI thing and, and the fact that, again, there's still no formally verifiable source for who owns what address space on the internet.
Well,
until that exists, you can't secure the routing system. And, fortunately right now, V4 address space is getting to run out and V6 is coming and the regional internet registries are developing stuff to help control address space, something specifically called RPKI or resource PKI. And, some of the stuff is happening in the IETF in a secure interdomain routing working group and some's happening, with the RIRs in this, registry certification mailing list. And, basically, the gist of it is that when you give address space to someone, you find out who's authorized to originate that address space, and you have a cert, and you have trust anchors and different things that that provide a hierarchy for people to verify what sources are able to originate what prefixes. And once you do that, you can use it for things like Internet Routing Registry filters, which can definitely be gamed today, but they're sort of the existing high bar. And then at the end of the day, you want to use it directly in a secure routing protocol like secure BGP or secure origin BGP or something to that effect.
Okay, well, what I was going to ask, sorry man, I'm still reeling from all of that. How well will that deal with flexibility? See, at the moment, one of the advantages, of course, of having, you know, flexible BGP is if the internet has, I think I read in that Wired story, has a bad hair day and stuff gets a little bit out of, you know, out of whack, you know, the BGP is very useful for maintaining overall net health. Can you still do that while locking down an effective trust model?
Yeah, one of the things today that's nice, and, you know, it's easy to run an insecure network because, you know, you can advertise any route you want at any time. You can update stuff. You can multi-ohm. You don't have to have authoritative databases. You know, one of the problems is today the network is the database, right? It's the most, you know, most reliable, most, you know, most up-to-date database we have is the routing system on the internet. Right? No, I mean, and, you know, I mean, that's pretty pathetic, actually. And that's why, you know, for literally 15 years, you know, nearly 20 years, you know, work has gone into this. It's just two things haven't existed. One is the authoritative database for who owns what hasn't existed. And the registries are working on that now. And if that exists, then the service providers can use that information and either directly in a secure routing protocol or to populate, you know, routing policy on their network. And the reality is you're going to have to do it. The infrastructure is too vulnerable today, and there's too many critical applications and services running on the internet to, you know, to continue to ignore this. And so, what, you know, what's really changed in the last couple of years is this work on RPKI specifically and the fact that the registries are doing some development work there. And, you know, that at the end of the day is, you know, is going to be basically the egg, and then, you know, the ISPs can start deploying, and then the router vendors are going to start having to provide more scale and processing capabilities to support that. But, you know, it's been too open for too long, and, you know, the infrastructure is really too vulnerable to continue in this manner. And, you know, and some people have known this for a very long time. And I think what, you know, what Tony and Alex basically highlighted or provided a proof of concept of, you know, something besides just the denial of service attack you can do with this, which was intuitive to a lot of folks, but apparently it shined a light, you know, and really illustrated it for people that needed to see it.
In terms of a solution for enterprise listeners who might be listening, I mean, really all I need to do is set up some checking and make sure that they're actually watching watching for this sort of behavior.
Well, it's not that simple, actually. One of the problems is that if you're an enterprise in Sydney and you're advertising your route to, say, you know, Telstra Optus or whoever it is you're getting your internet connectivity from, and somebody in the U.S., you know, in Vegas at a conference advertises your route to, you know, just to the local provider to prove that they can hijack your address space, then, you know, you may never see that. And so that's, you know, that's one of the challenges. There's sort of this tragedy that comes.
Well, hang on, Danny. Like, what about when they start feeding that traffic back to you? I mean, you know, isn't
it? So the thing is, they may not feed the traffic back to you. They can certainly feed it back to you, but the only thing you may see a difference of is, you know, transaction latency or propagation delay, right? You know, because you can obfuscate, you know, some of the TTLs and some of the other stuff depending on how they implemented it. So it's certainly, basically, one of the problems with this, just like the DNS thing, actually is, you know, the internet's basically a loosely interconnected set of, you know, autonomous systems or routing domains, and somebody can have a policy of routing one of those routing domains that other people don't see. And so, you know, if you're an enterprise in Australia, and, you know, and somebody's announcing your address space to a couple of ISPs in the U.S. and saying, don't tell anyone else to those ISPs with, you know, lots of different routing policies that exist today, then you may never know that. And, you know, and depending on what they want to do, they may want to route it back to you. They may want to intercept it. You know, they could do any of a number of malicious things. You know, so one of the problems is a lot of the enterprise say, hey, you know, I don't know how many routes I have. I want to advertise these in different prefix links. I want to do different things. And so the providers don't filter. They put pretty lax filters.
Yeah. Just do what you want. You know, you're the customer. You're always right.
No, exactly, right? I mean, it's, you know, and that's what's led to something. I mean, because, you know, when I worked for Internet MCI in 1996, and all of our customers were filtered based on, internet routing registry entries. And today I can tell you that it's done nothing but deteriorate since that time.
Yeah, it's a bit of a mess, isn't it?
No, exactly. And so anyway, the thing that really needs to happen is enterprises need to push their providers, say, hey, what are you doing about routing, you know, about routing security? And at the same time, you know, one of the things that I recommend is if you're concerned about this kind of thing is, you know, there are people out there and there are looking glass, like there's a Oregon Exchange Route Views project where you can go look at this, you know, look at this, these routing tables or even have a user interface to something called BGP Play. And it lets you see what, you know, who's announcing what prefixes from, you know, from what sites, that kind of thing. And then there are, you know, commercial companies, for example, Renesas and others that actually, provide route table monitoring services that say, hey, someone's hijacked this prefix in this location.
Well, isn't that funny? Because I know that there's some companies out there, I think RSA is one of them, that provide DNS monitoring solutions as well. So it's like, we have the service to tell us where to route our And then we have the service to make sure that the service is telling the truth. So it's just...
And then they're the ones, so the DNS side, the routing side, and then just the basic, transaction side. And then, finally, I guess the last bit of this to complete what I wrote in my blog and what I believe is, this is one more reason as well why end-to-end encryption is your friend, right? As you may think your traffic staying local or between two trusted networks, but it could be, routed somewhere else on the internet.
And I think what we have to point out here is that Alice and Bob had it right all along.
Precisely, exactly.
Yeah, all right, Danny. Look, we're going to have to wrap it up there. We've run out of time, but thank you very much for joining us here on Risky Business once again.
Oh, always appreciate it. Thanks, Patrick.
Arbor Networks, Danny McPherson there on the line from the US of A. And he was actually in Australia about a week ago to talk at Osnog. So there you go. We just missed him and had to get him the week after. Up next, it's time for this week's sponsor interview with RSA's Greg Singh. Now, without our sponsors, Risky Business just wouldn't exist, as you've probably heard me say every week. So each week, we give them a bit of airtime. It's only fair. And this week, Greg and I are chatting about poor implementations of RFIDs, contactless and other. Think about the MyFare card as used in the London Underground under the brand of Oyster, the Oyster card. You know the one, it feels about as insecure as a crack-addled anorexic teenager whose daddy don't love her. You'd think the brainiacs who rolled it out designed it in 1987, but oh no, this wonderful technology, as you'll hear, is fairly recent. Greg, illuminate us.
Well, we've been doing some reading about the MyFare Classic, the RFID crack that's been out there. It's very interesting what's going on. I mean, not only has it been revealed, I guess is the way to say that it's been a fairly weak key space. It's only a 48-bit key space and a large implementation of this globally. You know, we see that as a great exposure for cryptography in general. It just doesn't make a good noise out there for those that are, say, from the business side, that are just going, hey, this doesn't look good.
Yeah, well, I mean, 48 bits, it's what were they thinking?
I think they were thinking about 20 years ago.
Yeah, but when did they roll this out? It's fairly recent, isn't it?
It is fairly recent. Some of this was rolled out as early as, I think, February this year.
Oh, my God.
The actual, when you look into the actual, the crypto that was used, that in itself is also reasonably weak. Mm. And the method by which the randomness parameter that pops into the algorithm can also be forged. So it's quite easy for a hacker to actually get this sort of information freely off the internet, I dare say, and then probably to reproduce it.
So not only were they using a 48-bit key space, but they were using a weak random number generator as well.
Well, the method of generation can be easily intercepted. So in other words, someone could actually generate their own randomness and then push that back into the master system to give proof of understanding of the private key.
Oh, man.
It's a very messy situation. I mean, thankfully, MyFare has come up with a new system called MyFare Plus.
A bigger key space? Or
it is a bigger key space.
Yeah, you'd hope so.
I think they've gone up from 48 up to 128, which is, look, every time you add one bit, we're doubling the key space.
Yeah, no. And 128 seems to be that, okay, we're safe for the next 20 years sort of...
For the time being.
Yeah, exactly, But 128, I think if you just do some... brute force calculations to work out the average time that it would take to crack a 128-bit cipher, it's pretty extreme.
Well, I think if you look at the number 2 to the 48, it's probably going to pop up as just numeric values on your calculator.
Yeah.
If you look at 2 to the 128, it's got an E value and something like 38 at the end. So
yeah, exactly.
It's substantially larger.
Yeah, no, it's nice and chunky. Well, there's a perfect example of self-rolled crypto that's pretty crap.
Exactly.
How frustrating is it for you working for a company that's, really known for crypto solutions, seeing people absolutely bollocks up their crypto implementations with things like this Oyster card and the e-passport snafus?
I think probably the frustration is not the right word. And I probably a couple of years ago, I would have said, it would surprise me. But, as we delve further and further into the industry, I think I start to see more and more of this type of inappropriate application of cryptography. I guess over the time which I've been involved with RSA, it's surprised me less and less poor implementations of cryptography out there.
Mm-mm-mm. What are some of the common mistakes you see being made?
People don't know how to manage keys. That is a key issue. Excuse the pun there.
Zing! Try. He's here all week. Try the veal.
People using weak ciphers.
Mm.
And particularly people using things that don't have mechanisms to detect when they're being attacked.
Mm.
So you can actually, you know, launch a brute force attack against a number of different mechanisms. And, I mean, if you try hard enough and long enough, you can actually crack things.
Well, it depends what sort of key length you're talking about, but yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, if you had 10 times the life of the universe, you'd be able to break SSL at 128-bit, but I don't have that sort of time.
No, that's right.
It just seems that every time someone tries to... It's not just weak ciphers, but it's custom ciphers, and it seems every time someone tries to roll their own cipher, they think, oh, well, you know, we'll just do it ourselves, we'll implement it ourselves, and it'll be nice and obscure, and no one will know how to break it. And it's just... It doesn't work that way, does it?
No, in fact, history has shown that that has never worked. Anyone who's tried to do security by obscurity has always fallen into the same trap, which is they will be broken. A number of different ciphers over the years that have not been published prior to them going into production environments, just about all of them eventually end up being compromised.
Now, is RSA still really active in crypto research? Because that used to be your thing.
Yes, it is. Yeah, very much so. RSA maintains the RSA labs. We continue to develop different methods of cryptography. One of the key areas for us has been around key management. I know I mentioned that up first, but we see that as a key area of research and development around you know, how people are going to control keys. And indeed, the ciphers are also another area. We have a number of mathematicians that just sit there ticking away day after day, trying to come up with bigger and better ideas for how to do things.
Yeah, well, the key management stuff's hardly sexy. You know, you don't need the world's finest minds working on that. You just need to sort of sit there and painstakingly go through it and make it usable. But no one's been able to crack that particular nut, have they? I mean, key management is just... Like, perfect example, we had Peter Goodman on the show a few weeks ago talking about biometric passports and the security or lack thereof in those passports. And he found that, you know, you could actually overwrite the data on these chips, sign it with some completely fictitious key, and then run it through a, you know, e-passport gantry at most immigration departments, and it wouldn't even flag as non-genuine because no one was actually hooked up to the key database, which showed the, you know, which would allow you to verify that the correct signing key had been used. So it's baffling that, you know, even a project like that can still get it so horribly wrong.
So, I mean, in this type of situation, like, the cryptography is good, but the process behind it is bad.
Mm.
So what we're looking at is a situation where people haven't had, well, countries in this situation, it hasn't been mandated to them, and countries make their own decisions, it hasn't been mandated that they'll share a common repository of public key information.
Mm.
So how would you know? I mean, some countries do, and Australia does actually participate in one of these, but some countries don't. And so if you do actually get presented with a key that's supposedly from them, how would you know?
Yeah, no, it's a real bloody mess. And, you know, the more you try to centralize it, there's the centralized approach and then there's the federated approach, and there's problems with both. I mean, with a centralized approach, you've got to worry about who's got authority. And the problem with the federation approach is because no one's got authority, really, it doesn't seem to get up, you know? It's just... Do you see what I mean? They're two opposing sort of ideas, but they're both flawed, it seems, in terms of getting started up.
In terms of countries in particular, where they want to do their own verification...
Mm.
It's very difficult for one country to say, I'll just trust you implicitly because another country says so in this electronic age. Now, I would say that that has been the case in times gone by, where one country will issue your passport and that's usually accepted on face value at another country.
Yeah, but these days...
Times are changing.
All right, well, look, Greg Singh, thank you very much for taking some time out to speak to Risky Business again.
Patrick, thanks very much.
RSA Securities' Greg Singh on the line there with a chat about the wonderful MyFair card. I'll be heading to Rotterdam in a couple of weeks to have a chat with the guys who actually did that research, by the way. So keep on tuning in. That's the GovCert conference in the Netherlands. I've booked my ticket and I'm quite looking forward to getting over there. Thanks again to RSA for sponsoring this week's edition of Risky Business. And that's all she wrote for this week. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.